is he?
He's great.
Did it end like you told me it ended really badly?
Yes, it did. That was many years ago.
It was tough. I'm really sorry about that. Look, I know he was a friend of mine and I know there was some complications between us also, but I just don't like to see you upset in the way that I saw you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really happy you're moving on, and but just want to see you happy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Feel like you deserve it, and yeah, the way you treated you wasn't cool.
Mm-hmm.
Do they know about this?
I don't think so.
Mm. Do you not put much of your private life on this podcast?
No.
Why is
that?
Do
you put your private life online?
Some of it. I like to feel like you have to give to receive.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there's always a segment that I keep to myself.
Mm-hmm. So have you healed?
From?
there's
multiple wounds, so you have to be very specific about what I'm healing from. Have I healed in general in life?
Has your heart healed?
From a specific thing that happened to me?
Mm.
No, I think you're in a perpetual state of healing. There's always things throughout life that are kind of causing wounds, and it scabs and another wound comes in your... But it's that process of what life is, isn't it?
So one thing you do know very well how to do is how to literally escape a question.
Oh.
Have you been told this before?
No, never before. But what was the question? Have I healed? Gosh, like, where do I start? The world is imploding. Personally, it has an effect on us.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I've been heartbroken in the last year. Mm-hmm. Well, heartbroken's a big word. There's so much to heal from that it kind of, you kind of take it as it is, and you kind of just, at sub level, you just kind of feel like, this is life. Like, life is part of me. Actually, a teacher said something to me recently that I thought was really interesting, said that life was never meant to be easy, right? Life is a series of challenges in which we're supposed to overcome. And for people that expect life to be easier or wish that things could have been easy to them, you're missing the whole concept of what life is about. Life is about challenges that we overcome. And in some ways, I've had it now at this stage of my life, at this age, an added appreciation for challenges that don't obviously cause cataclysmic changes to my life, but like when challenges come and they force me to kind of rethink who I am or rethink like a certain my morals, my ethics, and I'm very grateful for those opportunities because it's very clarifying.
Wow. Well, someone said to me that becoming an adult is realizing that it's not being happy until you have a problem, but it's about just the different life challenges that you have and just how you get better at dealing with them.
Yeah, like look, if anything over this last year, which the world has kind of been turned inside out, has kind of taught me is what I'm very grateful for example, is I felt like God was giving me an opportunity to understand the difference between doing the right thing and being perceived as doing the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of good deeds and a lot of the right course of actions are usually done in silent and people don't realize that. And you know, more than anyone, that we operate in a very public space and like your actions are scrutinized. They're also, you know, they analyze on a myopic level, but there's so much that is done in secret, which is arguably even more important.
Mm.
And I've come to realize that my relationship with myself and the whatever you believe a greater power is very important to me. But I felt like that power that God, Allah in my case, was telling me, okay, cool. Like here's some clout, here's some success. Imagine that's all taken away from you. What are you really about? Are you still about this work that you put out to, or you started? And I like to feel like I behaved in a way that's still consistent with my initial intentions. You get tested. And I'm grateful for that reminder because there's a lot about this lifestyle that we live that it can be distracting. So those reminders are very welcome.
Wow. So this is why I don't bring men on the podcast, by the way, because they take over.
Oh, no, just because, you know, there are no questions. So sometimes you feel like you have to like fill it out.
Can I do my introduction? Like, do you mind?
These podcasts usually happen. I'm like, geez. Yeah, well, do the introduction, Sheen. Take over your podcast. Let me do the introduction. Hey guys, welcome to the Sheen podcast. It's called the Sheen podcast.
Wow.
The Sheen podcast, where Sheen is this incredible polyglot, or she's super talented and multifaceted, and she sees the world through a very unique lens. Today she's got an average guest, and that is me, Nadir, and I'm just here to kind of alley-oop or to supervise the story that is Sheen today, because she's made it very clear to me that she's the main character of this story. So Sheen, where would you like to start today? Tell me something else on your mind.
First of all, let me do my introduction. Okay. Hello and welcome back to Dream Girl. I'm Sheen, your host. The podcast is called Dream Girl, Nadir, just so you remember. And today I have a friend of mine who I haven't seen in a while, because you need to invite him on a podcast in order to get him anywhere. He's too famous. I'm sure you've either seen his food videos, or you've seen him running on the beach somewhere or traveling to random places. But just to course correct, I told you not to say this on the podcast because people need to like me. The first thing you said is that she said this about herself. Don't bring your friends on the podcast, guys. Anyway, yes. So Nadir.
No, I'm very grateful to be here, by the way. Thank you for having me. I know it's been a long time coming, but I think the way you see the world is really unique, and it's a privilege to have a conversation with you.
Thank you very much. Mm. My first question for you is, I would love for you to tell the guests, the audience, a little bit more about you. Mm. And what I find extremely fascinating about you is how you have very interesting roots, right? You're mm-hmm. so diverse. And I think that, I mean, I'll let you say it, but I think it played a huge role into who you are mm-hmm. and how you're able to literally bring anyone around you into your orbit.
Thank you. That's very kind. For those that don't know me, I'm very mixed. I'm Yemeni, Pakistani, Indonesian, Kenyan, which for a lot of people on the onset are very shocked by. They're like, wow, that's a lot. I was born and raised in London. But actually, you scratch beneath the surface a little bit more and you start to realize that these cultures have weirdly always been in conversation throughout time. They are on the periphery or the perimeter of the Indian Ocean. So they've been trading, they've been conversating over centuries. In some ways, for me, it feels like I am a child of this Indian Ocean, which is a way that I've been really enjoying identifying with recently. And this kind of context, this home, this multicultural environment I grew up in really informs like my life and my work now, which I would describe myself as a storyteller, as a creator, as a creative, as a filmmaker. And what I'm trying to do, what I'm really passionate about, is to create stories for people who see the world through this multicultural, multifaceted lens, which isn't necessarily narrowed down by like the traditional confines of how we identify with, but starting to see a world that is a lot more open, that is a lot more together and tolerant of one another. And I always thought if it happened in my house, then surely it could happen everywhere else in the world. And I try to create output, experiences, content that is in line with that ethos.
Mm-hmm. When was that? Because I know your story, but when was the tipping point for you where you thought, okay, you know what? I want this to be my main thing of creating content and telling important stories.
Accident, actually, like most of us, I'm sure. Mm. Like a lot of us in the space, kind of, I don't think none of us, especially that generation, I think we are really actually technically still the first generation. None of us, mm-hmm. I mean, actually, I think what we align with a lot is that we come from academic backgrounds mm-hmm. and then we kind of never probably imagined going to university that making content online would be a thing to do. My family were also publicly supportive, but deep down probably freaking out that content was, you know, I was making content regularly and I wanted to commit to it. I made a video, it went viral.
Which one was it?
Do you remember Pharrell came out with a song?
Oh yeah, the happy song, the one you did. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And although I wasn't frontlining that video, I completely made it happen. Mm. I leveraged my community overnight, got 1.7 million views. And this is before YouTube was seen as like what we understand today. It was when like YouTube was like just a graveyard of content, like cat videos, random things.
Pranks.
Mm. And it blew up. And then I realized, wow, like video is a new medium in which people are communicating. And it's also so empowering to have a platform in which I could represent my community in a way that they'd never had been before. Mm. And I felt very emboldened by that. And kind of cliche millennial story, left my job the next day and went down this path and never looked back. So it's obviously evolved over the period of 7-8 years. And I have to say, I'm very happy that this is my life in terms of what I get to do. But of course, it comes with its own stresses.
Mm. Let's talk about that, the certain stresses. Because, you know, a lot of the people I meet are usually people who have very similar journeys to us, who, you know, were training for specific jobs, people who are in corporate, making a lot of money, but probably not feeling fulfilled and not following their passion. And I think they probably look at us thinking, oh, well, they've got it easy. They got it figured out. But I know, and I'm sure you know as well, how on a day-to-day, it's not the same. Mm. It goes woo, woo, woo. So how do you deal with the, I don't want to say instability, but, you know, with like the unpredictability of it?
I mean, like just to caveat what I said before, I think the thing when someone asked me the other day, like, what are you most proud of? Mm. The biggest achievement that you're proud of? And I have to say it would be acquiring the agency to define how I work and when I work. And like that for me is like priceless. So like I can choose from where in the world I want to work, what I work on to some extent, well, mostly. And that kind of liberty to kind of on a day-to-day basis decide that I want to wake up at like 10, 11 a.m. and then work throughout the night, mm-hmm. every day a bit different. I love that. That's what I've chosen for my life. However, my sister, born and raised in the same house, is a lot more type A, a lot more OCD. Things are like planned to a minutia, Excel sheets, color-coded. My lifestyle gives her anxiety. And for her, this ad hoc, laissez-faire way in which I live my life, which is kind of willy-nilly creative, kind of every day is something different. She hates that. So no way do I want to project that my lifestyle is something aspirational for everybody. But for people wired like us that need stimulation from what they do constantly, it's been ideal. But some of the stresses that we have to face are things like instability in the sense that we don't know what tomorrow is going to offer. You know, like when you're future planning, financial planning, these are stresses that we learn to get better with. There is also no model for us. Mm-hmm. We are the first generation still, I would argue, that's still figuring out what it's like to build families in this context of content creation and creativity, mm-hmm. financial planning, what it looks like in the future. We don't know if we'll have an industry in the in next year, TikTok being bought off, and like, you know, this is real stresses that we have to deal with. But of course, it comes with immeasurable positive results and relationships, which I'm really, that's probably the one thing actually that I love the most out about this world is the relationships of people through it. But yeah, it's not without its challenges, of course.
Yeah. I like how you talked about financial planning and stuff, you know, because even here, even if you're a content creator, you don't really qualify as having a salary. So then it's not as easy to, for example, get a loan or buy a car. And I think people don't, they don't see that initially when they think, let me do that. But as you said, for me too, the main reason was the freedom of time. And I hated being told what to do when. And I'm the same as you, all night, you know, I need to be working at night and not in the morning. So it's good to decide what's important for you and what's not.
But then look, I've been reflecting a lot and being like, I really find it really admirable people who commit to their work for the sake of their families, for example. You know, there's some people with a philosophy that I'm going to hustle for the first 15 years of my career, buy, get that mortgage, get that house, make sure that my family's in a really financially secure place. And that's incredibly admirable. Like, I really respect people who do that. So there's like, I don't throw shade for people who live a very different life than mine. But I just know that for me to be the best human I can be, best partner I can be, best future father I want to be, it really requires me to be doing things that I'm fulfilled with personally. I need that. Some people don't. They need it less. So, yeah, like we're still navigating it. But it's interesting because the industry is also becoming a lot more regulated. They introduced an influencer tax here recently. That would be interesting. Now. Yeah. I mean, I'm still like most of my life in Britain, so I still get taxed like 40%. But we will learn to negotiate this space, which has been ad hoc before. And maybe it's a good thing in some case.
Also, you mentioned your sister. My sister is the same. My sister is proper corporate girly, been one her whole life. Yeah. And she loves the structure and, you know, the order of everything. So my life gives her anxiety.
But you're a bit interesting, actually, like because you are like my sister in the sense that you are very organized. And you're very academic, obviously, and formulaic, etc. But then you are operating within a very creative space, which is really like all over the show. How do you negotiate that?
Honestly, it was hard. At the beginning, that's why I think I was holding on to being employed because that gave me the structure. And I was trying to put that structure in the creative part, but it doesn't work. You know, it doesn't, especially creativity doesn't flow the same way. But since I made the jump, now I figured out, you know, building systems around creating content for me helps me. And then the actual creativity, I need to learn how to go with the flow. And I think for me, that has been an important lesson anyway in life because I was too rigid. And therefore any change, anything unplanned that would come up would really stress me out. Now I've learned how to just roll with the punches.
Do you mind if I ask like how you're feeling about your work right now? Like, are you feeling fulfilled?
Jesus, why is this about me?
Because through you, I'll be able to understand myself better. So like, are you feeling like if it was a graph, where do you feel like you're in that graph? Are you still feeling like an upward trajectory or do you feel like you're kind of petering off?
Okay, that's actually a very good point. And I'm going to go back to what you said at the start, where you said that, you know, when you felt like Allah was telling you, I give you clout, I give you this, but what do you stand for at the end of the day? Are you doing it for the money? That rang a big bell in my head, because last year was a very big year for me. Like, everything was growing. And then end of year, the year, it kind of like plateaued and I panicked for a minute. I was like, is this true? Is this what people are saying true? Like, all of these things are very temporary and you can't really kind of like ride the wave forever.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking, oh no, how do I make more money? And then that clarity came a bit later down the line of, but why am I doing this? At the end of the day, what made me leave all the comfort and all of the financial stability for this? Mm-hmm. What was the initial reason? And that happened because, you remember when we met in Qatar, and there was this woman who came to speak to me there, and she was like almost 60, and she came up to me saying, you probably don't realize this, and I'm not your target audience, but I love your podcast. And she was like, your podcast is the reason why I have a better relationship with my three daughters, because I didn't understand what you go through at that age.
Beautiful.
She was like, even in terms of dating, I kept putting pressure on my daughter to find a husband. And then when I listened to one of your podcasts, she told me which one it was. And she was like, it blew my mind. She was like, I was crying the whole time. I was like, this is what I'm doing to my own kid. And she was like, so I just want to say thank you. And then I sat with it for a minute, being like, I forget that my whole point is impact. I want to help others. And if that is still working, then I should not care about numbers. I should care about impact and the quality of the impact and reaching more people. Yes. Reaching different people, but not necessarily money and all of that. That comes. And that gave me a bit more clarity. And now I've written it and stuck it on my mirror. Then I remember your why. And that's helping me to go.
That's really beautiful. That's amazing. And I actually witnessed it in Qatar. There were some young girls also that came to you at the end of the trip that said similar things, like that does give you like an added injection of like passion and a reminder of why you're doing what you're doing. But it's also hard, right? For me, like the last year, especially, we've realized, look, I'm a storyteller, right? And why I started the work that I do is because I believed the work of telling stories and humanizing people that look like me, that believe in things that I believe, would result in a more equitable, empathetic world that we live in. And then something like the last 16 months happened and you realize nothing's been done. You haven't even moved a needle. And then you're like, why the hell am I doing this if it's still resulting in people like me being killed, maimed, murdered? And that was the biggest thing, the biggest heartache, but also creative block that I felt over the last year was like, what has all this effort been for? And navigating that over the last 16 months has been tough. Look, I'll be honest with you, I haven't posted any content in the last like 2.5 months. And a large part of that is just kind of felt like, what value does this have? Really, it's so ephemeral. My content's there 1 minute, it's gone another. And yeah, maybe I need moments like what you had where someone actually tangibly offline has come up to me and mentioned something like that to make me feel motivated again, which is why I've been really like kind of positioning myself to do a lot more IRL events, because I really feel like when I meet people face to face, like that's when I feel like a humanity in which I feel is lacking in the world. I just want to see people. I want to touch people. You know, there's so much talk about AI and like tech and like everything's digital. And a large part of that is part of the dehumanizing process. We've really forgotten what it's like just to be able to breathe in the same space with one another. And what I really want to, I think what my gut's telling me is that I just want to really be involved with facilitating space for people more in community. I feel like community is at risk. I feel like the fact that we can't eat together on the same table, we can't talk to each other, we can't feel each other's energy is resulting in us having a deep lack of empathy towards one another. And I think as technology takes us away from that more and more, we have to, the human in us has to pull us back to that. And I feel that's where I feel like my creativity is heading more and more so. But yeah, that's an untethered thought. It's not really finished, but like, that's where I feel like the pull is for me. I kind of want to feel more human in myself, but, create spaces that allows others to do that also.
Okay. Well, me being kind of like a external person to you and your creative process. I think even before we met, I remember your happy video. Mm-hmm. And that one was a big, big win, I would say, for the British Muslims at the time. Mm-hmm. It felt like we were not really in social media. And then I remember that video doing really well and everybody knew about it. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered you through your cooking videos. And then the number of people, when I told them that I was recording with you today, they all mention one cooking video that they've seen of yours about a specific country that's related to them. Mm-hmm. You know, and I would say from that point, you've definitely touched people in different ways from the content that you do and making them feel a bit closer to their identity, their roots, and, you know, being a bit more in touch with who they are. And I think you've done that beautifully.
Thank you. Thank you. I think like a lot of that is just like, I've been trying to figure out what that is, obviously, for myself. Because what I'm really passionate about is like to empower as many of us as possible to tell the best stories of our people as possible. So like, what is it that makes someone feel like, oh, Nader, thank you so much. That really spoke to me. And like it put into words an experience that I was finding difficult to articulate. A lot of that is like, I grew up in a very multicultural home, but my parents facilitated a space for me in which I was deeply in love with the cultures I came from. Like I loved them. And what does that mean to actually like love a culture is that you have to love the good and the bad, and there are good and bad things about our cultures, but like the good things, the little intangible things, like, you know, I was just with some Yemeni family recently, and like, you know, when you greet the elders, there's an order, there's an etiquette to it, there's a ritual, and you go and you kiss the hand of the eldest person in the room and you work your way around down descending age order. Little things like this in which I love, I want them to be part of who I am. And if you start to see the world with this love, you'll start to pick up on the little things about our culture, which are deeply, deeply powerful and meaningful. And I'm saying this, why I've like kind of come to this awareness is that after my father passed away, my father passed away in the beginning year of COVID. And what I realized is that there were windows into cultures in which he was from that had completely left from the house, right? I would come down every day. My dad would be speaking to relatives in Swahili and Arabic. And then when he passed away, I realized that that I didn't hear Arabic and Swahili in that house anymore. There weren't echoes of laughter in a language in which I would hear through him. And then through him passing, I realized if I want these cultures to be part of my life, then I would have to make a concerted effort to do it. Mm. I would have to like be speaking more of these languages. I would have to be facilitating my relationships with these parts of my family. So I came to realize that like, what are the things that I'm in love with these cultures and like, seeing them on a granular level, and there's so much to love. But one thing on which I've been like also reflecting on for myself is that, and I actually haven't really talked about this publicly, people think I talk about culture and identity and it's all positive and stuff, but there's a lot of tough things about culture in which we probably don't talk about less. Maybe because our cultures are always in the firing line for mainstream media.
Yeah, you don't want to add more.
Yeah. You know, it's like that situation where like, I can talk shit about my culture, but you definitely can't.
You can't.
So what happens is that we kind of preserve the stuff that we know that we kind of struggle with, but it's there. But it's just that we don't live in a landscape in which we can share that because we don't want people to know us for those things as opposed to all the beautiful things. But there are things about our cultures that we really struggle with. And I'm from four. I'm going to marry someone who presumably is from different cultures, right? So we're going to have to make a decision about our house, about what that culture is going to be. Now, human beings are vessels, right? They can only contain so much. There's a glass of water here. You fill it. There's only so much water you can fill it with. So I already have four. She's going to have some. So we're going to have to negotiate with this vessel, which is our house and the culture of our future, what that cultural makeup looks like. Now I know because of that and how limited the vessel is that there are some things about my culture that I'm probably going to have to do without. Things that I'm going to have to like let go of.
Right.
And like, what are those things about the cultures that we're from that we're going to have to let go of? And these are things that young people today really have to negotiate. Mixed marriages are becoming more and more common. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to like align with people based on values as opposed to traditions and culture. So the tough conversation is being like, okay, cool. Like, hey partner, the culture of our house in the future, what's it going to look like? And we have to negotiate that very early. I recommend doing it as early as possible. And it's sad for me because there are some rituals and things that I associate with my father that maybe I have to leave behind, right? And maybe my kids won't have that as part of their life. Mm. There's a deep grief in that. And I'm trying to negotiate still for me right now, like what are those things? But I really feel like if you're someone who's also negotiating this in a mixed relationship or you're thinking about it in the future, is that you can't invite someone into your life until you've really figured this out for yourself. Because it would almost be what's the word? It would be unfair to that person until you've really grounded in a sense of self and where you are in that cultural makeup and religious makeup before inviting someone into that equation. Because if you're still not certain and then suddenly like a year down the line, 5 years down the line, you've suddenly changed, that person has been into your life with a certain expectation, which you've set.
Yep.
And it's changed all of a sudden, and that's not fair entirely. Mm. Sorry, I don't know how we got there, but like the whole point was about like loving your culture, right?
Yeah.
And like, and through this journey, I've learned to love deeply my culture, but also understand that some things won't play a role in my life anymore, right?
And yeah.
That's okay. Like, you know, I'm Yemeni, I'm part Yemeni, and I love my Yemeni culture deeply, the food, the traditions, the habits that we do. But Yemen, especially in some parts of Yemen, is also highly segregated in terms of gender. And and this is how we kind of have our majlis and we sit. But it's not part of my house now. And it was probably something that I'm going to have to like let go of because I don't really identify with it in my future. But there's also a lot of memories associated with that and how we kind of organize the dinner and all that kind of stuff. Stuff like that.
But you know how you are a mix of four cultures.
Sure.
And then your experience is very different from your individual parents, right, of them growing up. So it's just that I feel your kids will also have a very unique blend of cultures, not necessarily exactly yours, but still.
They will. But like we have to negotiate this. We have to figure this out now.
Absolutely.
I grew up thinking I was a rarity, but like in today's day and age, like it's becoming more and more common, right? Like I said, we're all meeting partners based on shared values, and globally, a lot of us share values, right? There's a global culture exists, right? Like you can't tangibly call it something, but when I go to like Dubai and I kick it with you, it's like, yes, there's a tandem energy. Then I'm in London, there's also a tandem energy with people there. Okay, cool. So we're having more mixed marriages. What are those conversations? We need to figure that out. I actually like really passionate about this because I feel like no one has really articulated what this conversation should be.
Okay, let's hear it. So one is deciding where you sit in your own culture and tradition.
Yeah, I feel like, look, like you, and also you could be just like Emirati, you could be just Indian solely, both parents, and still have a cultural tension because you grew up Indian in the house, but then there's a culture outside of the house which you're navigating, right? So it's not just people like myself who are ethnically mixed, but all of us as young people are negotiating a global Western culture, which we're kind of part of, whether we like it or not, and our religion and all this kind of stuff. And it's about figuring out that ratio. And it's hard because I'm not saying you're going to figure it out exactly. What you have to do is also find a partner on that same trajectory because you guys will shift and mold as you grow naturally. But there's a base layer of understanding in yourself in which you have to reach to be able to invite energy around you, not even just romantically, but platonically also. And these are things which I've come to terms with. When I was younger, it was very difficult to be mixed. I always was like craving for attention from other people. I was like, oh, like I wasn't Yemeni enough for the Yemenis. I wasn't African for the Africans. I wasn't like Asian enough for the Asians. So like for me, when I got older, I started to realize actually, you know what? Like this is my superpower. Like, wow, like I have so much culture in me. I can feel fully them despite being perceived as like part of them. And what a blessing that is. It allows me to see the world in a completely different way, to feel part of the world in a completely unique way. And yeah, so like that's what I'm passionate about. It's like, as this becomes more common in the future, how do we create conversations that make it more and more likely? Because I love being mixed and I really feel like it's added so much perspective and value to my life.
Yeah, but I'm the same, right? Because I'm not Indian enough for the Indian. I don't relate to being Indian, but African people don't accept me either. Exactly. And then it's just where do you belong? And then you're like, oh, well, I'm a bit of everything.
Well, people in Mauritius, right? Like, people in the Mauritius are a hybrid culture, right?
Yeah.
You guys are just a nation of people like me. So like, it's a fascinating duality that.
Actually. Right.
Yeah.
But going back to my question, what are these conversations that need to happen for people who are dating and getting to know each other that you think are important other than like culture, tradition, religion? What else do you think?
Well, let's say I'm dating like a should we keep it within brown culture? So let's say I'm dating an Indian girl, right? No, let's say I'm dating a Syrian girl.
Okay,
I'm dating a Syrian girl and it's amazing. She's amazing. Question that I should probably ask super early is there anything about my culture you think that I would struggle with, right? And you're saying this with grace, you're saying this with openness of vulnerability to make her feel comfortable to share that with you, right? So again, it's about creating an environment in which this conversation can be had. And she might share something like, I don't know, like maybe it's like certain cultural conservatisms that she might have. Let's say it's like a relationship with her father or something, or an expectation. Or how he should have relationships with her family. And you should be able to negotiate that, right? Not to say that like it's always done in the way that one of you expect, but there is a sort of compromise that can be had from just having that conversation. And then scratch deep enough and you find out that actually what I love about being mixed is actually all cultures are really pretty much saying the same thing, right?
Yep.
And why that conversation is important is arriving at that understanding. Okay, so why is my relationship with... Why is your relationship with my father important? Oh, it's about family. It's about values. It's about ethics, being filial. And every culture has these values. So once you scratch deep enough and you find that, that that's what it's about, you're able to like partake in it more. Expectations in the future. You should be asking like, how would I want to raise my kids, right? Maybe not super early on the first or second date, but like at some point you should be asking like, you know, the house that I want to build in the future, culturally, what does that look like? What are things that are important to me? You know, maybe doing a priority list of like, these are the things about my culture which I really love and I want to bring forward. These are the culture, these are the things about your culture which we really love and want to take forward. And maybe leave a third of the space for this is the thing that I think we'll build together and figure out ourselves, right? That might not be part of any culture. Because a large part, I think, of our responsibility as these modern, young, eclectic, creative, cosmopolitan generation is like creating a culture that we're proud of. You know, what I really hate today is that we have this idea of culture being really like crystallized. It's like been frozen in time. Like in Arab culture, it's been like crystallized of what it meant in the 18th century at this point. And this is how we have to preserve it. Identity, nationality, ethnicity, or whatever. Who decided that? At what point did this thing become like fossilized and we all have to like worship it as if it's some sort of like idol of cultural conformity? Ridiculous. Like culture, if you look at it throughout the dawn of time, is something that is organic, static, has always been like moving and growing. And I want to leverage back into that. Actually, a lot of the beauty of our global South culture, and I put all of Asia in this bracket, all of Africa, is that you look at like, which are why I love the Indian Ocean, is that you look at these countries and they've always absorbed cultures, right? Mauritius has absorbed the African, it's absorbed the Asian. And you look at Arabia especially, and like through conversations and like interactions with one another, cultures have amalgamated into something greater. But then over the last 100 years somewhere, I don't know what's going on, culture has been crystallized and people are excluded outside of that conversation. And I actually think culture's become weaker for it. Where as a mixed person, and maybe I'm biased because I am mixed, I actually think culture is like stronger when it accepts as much as possible and sees the value in everyone to add value to that culture. It doesn't diminish you. Like you're not any less Arab or any less Asian or whatever. Like that's crazy. So I want to get to a place in the world where like we start to realize that we all have value and can contribute to each other's cultures in really amazing ways, because it's inevitable. We're all intermingling, baby. And it's going to happen. And we just need to get to a place to understand that every culture has a beauty in it. And you just need to be able to identify it.
Amazing. Okay, question for you. One thing I notice about you, and okay, this is for all the female audience that we have here. One thing I notice about you is you are very self-aware.
The caveat got me a little bit nervous.
You're sweating a little now. You're very self-aware. I'm seeing something nice, don't worry.
I know, it's making me deeply uncomfortable as well. Sorry, finish. Go ahead.
Okay, let me restart. Is that you are very self-aware, and I would say you have above average emotional intelligence for a man.
Thank you, I think.
Above average.
Okay.
I didn't say very high. I said above average.
Yeah, average, I'll take it.
Yeah. Where do you think that comes from? Because one thing in the comment section that everybody talks about is how in today's time it's really hard to find a man who has even, you know, like basic emotional intelligence. So help the bros out there.
Oh, thank you, firstly. Well, I people do tell me this. I don't think it's that men... Well, firstly, I don't think it's that men do not have emotional intelligence. I just think I was raised around a lot of incredible women. So I think I understand and I speak a language which women are receptive to as a result of it.
But I think he knows how to manipulate.
But I think men are incredibly emotionally intuitive.
You think?
Would you, yeah, I do. I actually been having this conversation with some friends, and like, look, I have my own frustration with men in general, but I do think men are speaking an emotional language. I think it might not be the language that women want to hear, but they are communicating in a way, right?
Okay.
And, you know, there's so much amazing vernacular and language and vocabulary around how women receive emotional intelligence, but less knowledge around how men might be communicating emotionally. And men might be communicating indirectly, toxically. It might be all of these things, right? Yeah. But it's still a form of communication,
okay,
and indicative of a certain emotional depth that they might be feeling, even though they might be unaware of it. But like, I just feel like, yeah, I just feel like men are communicating. It might be nonverbal also. And I feel like at times, and then I don't, you know, maybe this causes a bit of drama between me and you, but like, I feel like women maybe aren't as receptive to it as they could be.
Okay.
Right?
Give me a for instance.
In my case, and this isn't heavy for me. I love talking about it because it was such a big moment in my life, right? Okay. But like when, for example, when my father passed away, it became very clear to me in that context what being a man is. And what do I mean by that? My house had just gone through a cataclysmic change of this huge energy. And my dad was a larger than life figure being sucked out of us in the context of COVID, by the way. So it was like first week, second week. And the women in my life, my mother and my sister, who are my world, were experiencing an incredible lack of agency and control. We couldn't even see him in the hospital. There was nothing you could do. And what I'm witnessing, I'm almost having like this outer body experience. I'm witnessing my mother. I'm sure they won't mind me talking about this, but I'm witnessing my mother trying to regain control in her context and how she understands that. She's organizing the house, taking things down, reorganizing it. She's kind of just like trying to find things in which she can maniacally like organize, right? My sister deals with things entirely different, where she becomes emotionally mute, doesn't say a word for 3 days, right? And I'm seeing like the most important two most important people in my life are like shutting down. And then I start to realize like, what is my responsibility in this context, right? And it wasn't necessarily to grieve or to like emotionally like speak about how I'm feeling. What our ship as a family needed was stability, right? But know that at that time with COVID, all my work has stopped. You know, we were getting kicked out of the house in like 6-7 months. There was like things to be paid for. Like work was incredibly hard for content creators and freelancers at that time. You're like freaking out, right? Your father, your shade, this tree has kind of left this world. And, like, you know, even his presence just gives you like a sense of security, but that's gone. So then you're trying to like figure out, you are freaking out, but you're trying to figure out what to do. But these two people need you to be like resolute and stable, because that's what a fatherly figure would have done in that context. So you do it, you step into it. So like you step in and you tell your mom, don't worry, nothing's going to change. Like nothing about your lifestyle is going to change. It's going to be exactly the same. You come across like you've got this figured out. There's a roadmap. Even though in the back of your mind, you're like, shit, I have no idea how I'm going to get this.
You're freaking out.
Right? And what that does is allow them to go through that process. Mm. Right? And they emotionally start to unravel and re-ravel. And then it makes you realize that like being a man in that context was your time to grieve isn't necessarily in the moment, but it will come. When there is space and time for it later down the line, but your immediate priority is the people around you. And like, that was a clear example. I felt the universe telling me this is your test of what manliness is in that context. Right. And that was providing stability, security, and assuredness to two women in my life who felt a lack of it. Right. And they always say that you only really become a man when your father passes away. But that kind of view of what being a man is became very clear to me in that context. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so like I don't actually think my mom or my sister knew that this was even my frame of thinking. Probably watching this, or probably that they don't even watch my shit, so they won't even hear this. But
they
like,
might watch mine though.
Yeah, exactly. True. But I don't even know if they know that that was my thinking at the time, right? That I was going through this, because I didn't need them to know that.
Yeah, but you made sure they didn't, right? Yeah,
exactly. That's what I mean. Like men do things when like people around them don't even know they're doing it. Right. And like,
no, but in this case, Nader is very loud.
It wasn't.
I'm sure they know. I know. I'm sure they know. They know that now you're stepping in to support.
I don't think so. I think there was, of course, there was an appreciation of what I was doing, etc. But like, to the extent I was taking consideration to make sure that they were comfortable, I'm not too sure. And not because like they're negligent or like whatever, but like I was thinking of like everybody else, I was thinking of like everyone else but myself. Mm-hmm. In that moment, it was just to make sure that these guys are okay, like blah, blah, blah. And like, I think that's cool. That's fine. Like that's, you know, la shukra ala wajib, we say in Arabic. There's no gratitude and like obligation. Like I will do that again and again for them to the rest of my life, right? But what I'm saying is there's a silent service done for people you love that for me is a form of like male communications, how they emotionally feel towards people, which isn't necessarily recognized outright, but is appreciated.
Mm.
And I do feel very appreciated by the girls in my life. But like at that time in the war zone, the guy's just getting on with it. But this is a very positive outlook of a certain example.
But also wait, that is emotionally so hard though, for you having to like basically shut down that part of you that also wanted to grieve and basically panic for a bit and have someone tell you that it's going to be okay.
I don't know. I've been thinking about this also. I've been thinking in the context of grief, being in the service of others is sometimes the most comforting place to be.
It is.
Because if you're, I don't know, this is just for me and I'm speaking for myself. I kind of feel like if I was left alone with my thoughts in that moment, I would have really struggled.
Mm.
But I think what got me through it was maybe kind of leaning into this role that I felt like I had to step into. It gave
you
me purpose.
A new mission.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right? Mm. And I think that's how I felt. It was like, okay, cool, there's a job to do. Mm. I'm the kind of guy, maybe it's kind of like, you know, like the athlete mindset, because sports has always been a big part of my life, of cool, game time. You step in, you step on the pitch,
mm-hmm.
you're on, right? And I think in my context, it was just, okay, cool. This is the Champions League final. Now you have to turn up for all the training that you've been had and it's game time. At least that's how it felt.
Yeah, but that's a bad example.
Of...
because we said not you. We know you are emotionally intelligent.
Oh yeah, true. That's why I paused. That's why I paused. But to use that example in the case of other men, I think men are like, have you heard these crazy stories of the data from like social media apps? Like, have you heard some of them? These data are crazy. Like I was reading a data report recently that said these social media dating apps have incredible data, right? Think about it. They have the sexual preferences of
mm-hmm.
a young generation mm-hmm. based on how you engage with these apps. For example, they can tell what men are swiping left and right for, men and women. Have you heard this?
No, but keep going.
Okay. It's incredible. So for example, based on ethnicity,
mm-hmm.
they can tell you what men are swiping left and right for the most and the least. If you had to guess what men are swiping left for the most based on ethnicity, what would you guess?
Black
women. Why?
Yeah.
Desexualized in popular culture, perceived as like angry
mm-hmm.
And maligned, alienated, blah, blah, blah.
Just
blah.
Generally racism.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Swiping right based on ethnicity for who?
I'm torn between white and East Asian.
Okay, you're one of the best ones that's actually answered this question. But East Asian, they are swiping right for why? Because they represent demure, traditional femininity, but also weirdly fetishized.
Yeah, that's what
culture.
I was about to say. It's all the fetishizing, yeah.
There's a weird kind of sexuality that kind of hovers around them. Now, women.
Mm.
Women are swiping left based on ethnicity for who the most?
Brown men, no?
As in, they're finding... Why'd you hate me? Just tell me you hate me to my face. Bro, man, can't get a break. Jesus. No, okay, so you think that women across the world are swiping left for brown men.
Yes.
See, it's brown women that hate brown men the most. Crazy. No, I'll tell you the truth.
Okay.
Women are swiping left the most for... East Asian men for very similar reasons.
Oh.
Emasculated, not seeing as macho, representative,
feminine,
a bit effeminate, etc. Yeah. Women are swiping right for who the most?
Black men. Mm-hmm.
Why?
Again, because of...
She's like,
how do we keep it alive?
I'm like, Jesus. Do you need a drink? You're a mess right now. Yes.
Why are you making me say
yes,
these things?
Black men, because they're like... seen as like macho, you know, embodying masculinity, mm-hmm. etc., all that kind of stuff, which is incredible data to have. Of course, these aren't true to reality.
So it's the polar opposite.
polar opposite, which is fascinating also, right?
Wow.
But like, of course, this isn't indicative of reality, mm-hmm. but it's indicative of an insight of people that use social media. Because mm-hmm. you have to break down intention, you have to break down like how people are using the app, etc. Mm-hmm. But the most interesting statistic is one that said, basically, they can break down that 80% of women, there are, I think 80, 85, are swiping right for the same 15% of men.
Yeah, that I knew.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is crazy to me. Crazy, crazy, crazy to me. Because what that implies is that there is like 85% of men left feeling undesirable, mm-hmm. Abandoned by mainstream desirability, mm-hmm. angry, upset, probably spend their lifetime putting themselves out there to women, but never having it received back, mm-hmm. which makes them vulnerable to people like incel and like all this kind of stuff, and believing that you can be sexy and powerful if you have a flashy car and money and glasses and Andrew Tate, da, 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 da. But I kind of like have empathy for that. It's like, it must be incredibly difficult to feel like no one is ever interested in you. Desirability is such an essential need for a human being to feel, which is why I believe flirting is really important.
Mm.
Right? With the,
yeah, we all know.
And that sounds crazy to people. But like, I think flirting with strangers, with random people in an innocent, wholesome way is such a wonderful thing to give someone, that in that moment that like, oh, you know that feeling where you just had a really lovely like spark with someone.
It's like giving a compliment to someone,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like that kind of serendipitous injection of just feeling like, oh, I am seen, or I am like desired in that little moment, and then gone. You go about your world. But in the void of that, imagine feeling invisible. That must be a really difficult reality to feel. And like, and I feel sorry for people that's part of their reality, or they feel like it's part of their reality, because it's a lonely place to be. And I wouldn't want that for anybody. And I think these men are communicating emotionally through their frustrations. They might not be able to articulate what they're feeling, and maybe I can't find the words for them. But, you know, just to have a woman smile at you, make you feel seen in that context, like, or feel heard or valued, or the values that you definitely have. You're a nice guy, you're loyal, you're dependable, you're convicted, you're competent.
Did you say convicted?
In your beliefs, when you you have conviction in your beliefs. These are, you know, imagine like having just someone see that in you. I think it would just completely change the way that they kind of behave in general.
Yeah, but don't you think this is a lot more layered than that though, right?
Of course, but I think that men lash out because perhaps a lot of them feel that actually the only reason, the only way they get a reaction from people is by being obnoxious.
Mm.
Like, you know when you're like sitting on the boulevard in Dubai and there's loud cars revving. But what is a man telling? A man is communicating. Genuinely, this is what I mean. Okay, this is an example.
But that's not a communication you want.
No, it's not what you want. That's completely different. Because one is a subjective term. This is how you want to receive information.
But is that intelligent?
Right?
Is that...
No, I mean, it might not be intelligent, but look, we're trying to break down how men communicate to understand why it's that case, right? So like when I'm sitting on Sheikh Mohammed Boulevard street and I'm having like a coffee and then I'm hearing these engines revving, it's telling me that you're one of those 85% of men that feels invisible. And in that moment, you think you're seen because you're revving your engine and it's a pathetic moment. I hate it. But also there's a deep empathy there because I feel like the only way they feel they're being seen is by making a loud and obnoxious noise, right? There's a feeling of insecurity that this car gives me a sense of value, right? That's what I'm hearing him say.
Yeah.
Right? And instead of just thinking, oh, dickhead, like what douche, what an obnoxious guy. I'm like, there's a deep empathy over there for someone who feels like, wow, my only value is how flashy my car is. And like, what if someone like acknowledged that in him and spoke to him about that and affirmed that? Maybe he might see the world differently. I'm not saying that's the responsibility of a woman. I'm not saying that they should do that.
Fine, you're a nicer person than I am.
But what I'm not saying it should be done. It's shitty. It's a shitty circumstance. What I am saying is that this is just the reality. Like, and you know, I feel like, you know, like we always say, I'm sure you've said it on this podcast already, men are victims of patriarchy in the sense of like,
agreed.
Of also, and addressing certain inadequacies they feel is really important. And maybe when we start to see that in them, they'll start to address it better.
Mm. Yeah, because I feel like a lot of the men from this generation feel like they did not choose patriarchy. Yes, they benefit from it, but they feel like they're being punished for it while they are trying to be better. And I definitely agree that the problem is not necessarily going to be resolved by us just hating all the men. But going back to what were we saying before you went completely off track?
you were talking about an example of me being emotionally intelligent. You were saying amazing things about me being amazing.
And that never happened.
You were saying how you thought I was very self-aware. That's the last thing I remember.
Okay. But okay, I wanted to touch on the storytelling before this ADHD conversation ends. But I know you started your storytelling course, mm-hmm. and we know that you call yourself a storyteller. And I think personally, I think a good storyteller has two things. The first one is the ability to notice things. You're very observant. And the second one is also having empathy and being able to read people's feelings and read the room whenever you're telling a story. And that's how you captivate attention. But tell me more about why do you think storytelling is important in today's time, and how can anyone apply it in their lives?
Absolutely. Like for me, storytelling is the crux of life, right? It's how human beings since the dawn of time have been communicating with one another. Like, you know, you can't really know where you're going in the future until one, you know where you've come from, but also you're able to like lay the bricks to that eventual future. And that's what storytelling is, right? Like a lot of being able to be a good storyteller really first is understanding what your story is. And this is the journey we're all on. We might not realize it, but we're all storytellers, right? Like we are all articulating, expressing what we're processing in that moment. And we're all trying to figure out what that eventual plot line is going to look like, right? And we're all living our hero's journey. So for me, I kind of feel like to be a good storyteller, you really have to understand the story of you. And this is why a lot of people struggle, because they find it hard to articulate the stories of others because they haven't really had a good grasp of who they are themselves. So how can you expect to tell anyone else's story? And understanding that you are part of an arc or a narrative, is really important in giving your life and perspective structure and purpose. But I've also really struggled with the concept of the story. And this is going to be the first time I've ever talked about this.
Let's hear it.
Here's a reflection I'm having around storytelling, is that I started to realize that, like, you know when Neo in the Matrix is like, realized he's the one? And he starts to see the algorithm and the code around him. The more you kind of are a student of storytelling, you start to realize that everything is storytelling. Everything. Whether it's a brand that's putting out some ethos down there, whether it's your mom and she's communicating with you why you shouldn't eat this carrot because there's some story involved that it's like good for you or whatever, or anything, but even religion, right? Religion is a series of parables because this is how human beings receive information, right? And some of the oldest stories ever told are sacred biblical stories, right? And once you're able to see the mechanics of a story, you're also able to see how people might engineer that, how people might manipulate it, how people might use it for their own advantage. And it starts to leave you in this kind of disillusioned space of like, what is real, what is embellished, and what is just fake between that. And especially in times of conflict, whether it's like a romantic couple, one and two of them have like different sides of a story, or whether it's politics and like one nation or the other, and then, you know, it's all a battle of information. Storytelling can either be a tool to like make us feel grounded in who we are, but also to like split people apart, to manipulate. And I've been really feeling as a storyteller, like what is the ethics around that, and struggling with that a lot, because there are, okay, it's really vulnerable. Like I'm very spiritual, right? I'm a Muslim and I believe in my faith a lot, but you start to realize that like even within our own tradition, there are stories in which we believe, right? Are we supposed to listen to the story as like a series of events or the outcome of that story? What's more important, right? And like sometimes I feel like things are being told to me through a story because it's the outcome that's the priority, not necessarily the mechanics of how you got there from beginning to end, right? Where some people could arguably focus on every single detail of the story and try to replicate that in their life today, but then miss on the outcome of what the story is supposed to be about. Does that make sense to you?
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right? And like...
I see what you're trying to say.
Right? I'm trying to say it in a way...
But don't you feel like sometimes different stories would have different points where you need to focus on? Like, for example, a story could be, the takeaway could be the ending.
Yeah.
But one of it could be just the different things that you learn along the journey of that story.
Yeah, no, definitely. But like, it's more like, for example, let's say if someone did A plus B and then they got to the outcome, people focus on doing A plus B.
Right. Yeah.
And then forget the outcome. But like, but maybe A plus B wasn't the whole point of the story, yeah. right? It was a story to get you to.
It's a moral the outcome, of the story, as right? that could be, yeah.
And that's what I'm kind of trying to say. Anyway, storytelling, what I've learned is like it's a tool. It's like a knife. It can be used to cut fruit, but it can also be used to hurt someone. And there's a huge ethical responsibility towards that. And the reason why, like, I really love educating people around storytelling is that, one, I think it grounds them in a sense of who they are and their own story, which is not only just a creative professional benefit, but also an individual life benefit for you to have for yourself. But when you come from communities that have never had the luxury of their story being told, how empowering is it in my mind to have this army of storytellers from people like us who are out there telling the most empowering, beneficial stories that have a great, great, profound impact in the world? That's the kind of place I want to get to. Like, I'm doing this courses right now, but I just have this like dream of having like this alumni of people who see the world in really profound ways that are creating content through creating stories through content, experiences, product. But it has this grounding ethos of being like understanding the weight and responsibility of being a storyteller and going out there and like just being the best version of yourself in that context. And that's kind of the inspiration behind it.
But I don't think there's any problem, is there?
No.
What's the dilemma?
The dilemma, like, that's different. The inspiration behind the storytelling course is that. The dilemma is that sometimes people misunderstand the ethics of the storyteller, right?
Mm.
The way of the storyteller, I like to call it, right? Think of it as a samurai code.
Mm.
Like I said before, storytelling, and why I use the examples of like ancient stories, is that storytelling can be used for bad things also.
Absolutely.
And like, I'm constantly asking myself in the context of the work I do, is this my story to tell?
Mm.
Right? Like, I've come to learn, whether it's like Sudan, Palestine, other countries around the world, etc. Like, if I'm going to tell this story, what am I benefiting from? Am I doing this for my own individual benefit or for the culture's benefit? And how do I tell this story that's in line with how people from that culture personally feel? Are they involved in that conversation about how to put it out there? And a lot of people maybe don't go to this meticulous detail,
of course,
before telling the story, and that's problematic, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to constantly figure out like how to be the best storyteller I can be, understanding that storytelling can also be incredibly dangerous if not done properly.
The fact that you're thinking about it tells a lot, no?
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Like to think so. But the thing is, it's very, in our space especially, there's very little room for error.
Absolutely.
Right? So like, it's so funny.
We've all been cancelled.
Well, you know what the irony is? I've been thinking about this also, is that like, there's so many like freaking Instagram memes about how failure is like your greatest teacher, and like you should like encourage an environment.
Collect your failure.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's no room for failure.
No. So no one forgives you.
Well, yeah, there's no room for forgiveness. There's no room for retrospection. So it's like, everyone's like saying what they want to say about, yeah, like create an environment where like your failure is your greatest teacher, but then we don't give people space to have failure as a teacher.
No.
So you kind of feel like you have to get it right, which is one of the biggest crux towards creativity, is when you feel like your every move is being scrutinized, right?
Yeah, and that really stifles creativity.
Yeah.
We need to have the freedom of failing. And I think everyone should be allowed a mistake. If they repeat the same mistake, then that's a problem, but everyone should be allowed a mistake.
But just to emphasize how important storytelling is, like this is our bloody front line now.
Yeah.
Like, I mean this, right? Like we're in a transitionary point in the world right now where like lines are being drawn, people are gunning up, strapping up. And I genuinely feel like the vanguard, the front line of this information war is storytelling, right? So if you are someone who's articulate, who has a passion for it, or a mild interest even, we really need to own how we tell our stories, get good at it, and put it out there into the ether. A lot of us have been excluded from understanding our own stories. Maybe we grew up in the West and were told that we were XYZ, and we kind of absorbed that over the period of our lifetime. So first and foremost, detach yourself from everything you've been told you feel like you are. Buckle up, get to know who you are, be grounded in that. Because now, over the next 5 years, I feel like, you know, being proud of who we are as people of color, people from the Global South with heritage from there, is so crucial in making sure that we are, we get what we deserve and are seen and perceived in the way that we deserve to be seen. That's what I'm really passionate about. It's just our people and their stories.
Mm. Yeah, and I think you're very right, because a lot of the times the conversation we've had on this podcast is we grew up, especially, you know, people from the Global South who grew up in the Western world, you grow up ashamed of your roots, right? You're bullied about it and you feel like you're too different. But now it's become trendy to be different. And even like our culture is being made into trends. on social media. So now suddenly it's cool to be different. It's cool to be from somewhere else. So I'm kind of happy about that. And I think it'll be better for our future generations.
It's funny, isn't it? It's like you go to school and you spend so much trying to be like everybody else. And then you go up and you're like, actually, I want to be different.
I don't want to look like
I don't want to be like anybody else. That's one of the greatest ironies of life for me.
Yeah.
But one thing I've been thinking about is like, especially when we talk about the ethics, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot. A lot of people ask me like, you should do more stuff on religion and spirituality. And I'm like, you know, why don't you do that?
Mm.
And I'm like, firstly, I keep the most precious things to myself, right?
Of course.
Matters of the heart and matters of the soul are like very important and precious to me that I like to keep it to myself.
Absolutely.
Right? And why I don't also, so what I'm seeing is I'm online and no shade to anyone, right? But let me just say like, this is what I'm seeing online right now, right? Is that there is a habit to use religion and culture as means of going viral. And a lot of people do a lot of good on these things, right? A lot of people, it's educational and they get a lot of value from it. But where I'm saying it's like the system, the apps, the way that they are run is algorithmically designed for you to identify what does well and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's going to shape what you put out there, right? So let's say like suddenly you're talking about a certain religious topic and you start to realize that, oh, actually this topic went viral. Maybe we should do more videos on this topic and have even more viral videos. This is the game, right? And what happens is instead of people doing, you know, actually telling people what they should be hearing, we start to put content out there that we know will do well,
mm-hmm.
which leads to a very toxic environment of the algorithm defining our religion, our culture, our values, as opposed to putting messages out there that the people need to hear. And ultimately, a lot of people are driven by wanting to get as many views and engagement as possible. And I'm veering away from that, ironically, right? I'm kind of feeling like I don't want to do what the algorithm is telling me what I need to do. I want to do what I feel will fulfill me, will nourish me. And sometimes that's the most antithetical thing to engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the new wave of like content creation for me, is people who are like done away with that. Like, fuck that. Like, cool. Sorry. I don't want to exploit my religion, my culture, because I know it will get me views and likes. Like, I'll tell you like an example of my work, right? I was doing a video series about this girl in Berlin who's a friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
Emine, and she was a dancer, a hip hop, one of Berlin's best hip hop dancers, right? And then I went to go film. 2 months later, she decided to put the hijab on. And I was like, oh, amazing. Like,
yeah.
I didn't have an issue with it.
Right.
She put the hijab on. And then I'm like, Emine, we're not going to say everything is going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want to say that you are a hijabi dancer of Berlin,
mm-hmm.
because it will take this video into a whole different direction.
Absolutely.
Where it like tokenizes you as a hijabi dancer, mm-hmm. as opposed to you being this incredibly talented woman doing your thing. But I know if I had done the video and made it hijabi dancer of Berlin, it would have got millions
viral.
Of views.
Yeah.
Right? And I would have been guilty of tokenizing and fetishizing my own faith for the sake of views.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And what I'm saying is that this happens, right? People are putting religious content out there, cultural content out there that like fetishizes who they are for the sake of engagement. And is that doing our communities any benefit? I would really encourage people to think otherwise, because what we need to be doing is start thinking what our communities really need, which requires awareness, emotional intelligence, like you said. And maybe it's not the most engaged content, but at least it's like providing our people what they need to hear to feel nourished and fulfilled for the future.
Oh my God, I'm so glad you said that, Nader. Louder for the people in the back.
I'm so tired of
that as well. And especially, you know, even in the podcast world, a lot of people are now filming fake casts.
Yeah.
Do you know what a fake cast is?
No. Oh, it's when you kind of engineer a podcast environment.
So there won't be anyone here. And it's just that camera on me. So it looks like I'm talking to someone, but they say these very niche things, right? So, and people will say things that will rile. And now a lot of people, I'm sure you've seen it, focus on hate engagement.
Exactly, terrible.
Right? So then you rile up people and in the comments, and then that's you just say something very like outrageous. And a lot of it is to do with culture. A lot of it is to do with specific countries. And a lot of it has to do with religion. I keep seeing like these new podcasts come up being like, Dawa expert says this. You know this is going to attract everyone to come watch it.
And for me, this is like really toxic. And I don't think people really, I haven't heard it been spoken about publicly really, to be honest
with
you.
No one says it.
So like, maybe people come for me and you, whatever, but I really feel passionate about this, because I feel like it's the worst form of exploitation is spiritual, right? And if you are, you know, using an algorithm and exploiting your faith as a result to benefit algorithmically and via engagement, there's a weird toxicity about that. But then again, who am I to say that? Because a lot of people derive value from these videos also. But I just don't like the idea personally for my own content of taking something so precious to me, which is my faith and what I believe in or my culture, and seeing it as a tool to garner more views for my own benefit. There's something weirdly, weirdly toxic about that, because spirituality is sacred. And that feels like a very profane, lacking of sacredness, transactional way to look at your faith.
Yeah, and for me, it doesn't sit well, because a lot of the time these viral videos, none of them are providing any positive value about the religion or the culture.
Right? We don't
know. I mean, the ones I've seen.
Yeah, some people might be taking, we don't know what people are taking value from, right? Sometimes like I post like a, you know, you might post a selfie and people will be like, oh my God, like there's, I love the way that she's done this selfie and have value from it. So we don't know what people are, I can't judge that.
Video is telling you, you know, Islam says the women should be in the kitchen and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm checking.
I'm in the kitchen.
Cancel him.
I'm the cook.
You are in the kitchen. The one thing I've noticed about you is any country you go, you have a massive group of friends waiting for you. And that's beautiful. You even went to South Africa for the first time and you managed to meet so many people.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for noticing.
And that's really nice. And I think you're very good at building community. Mm. And what's good about you is you're very welcoming to others to come into this community. Mm. But in today's time, the one thing that I keep seeing online as well is people complain about adult friendships. Mm-hmm. They think it's really hard to make friends when you get older, especially once you're out of uni.
Yeah.
Then where do you make friends other than your older friends? So how do you do it?
That's a big question. I get this asked a lot. And I have to say, it's probably the biggest blessing in my life. Mm. There are some things I think which I just learned naturally from having parents who are very similar. Gravitational, magnetic personalities. But one thing, and I'll quote my mom here, my mom always said, you have to build the community you want to be part of. A lot of this young generation has this entitlement complex where we feel like we should arrive somewhere and it should be easy for me to feel part of community. Yeah. When that is such an crazy entitled thing to say. Like, people might see the friends that I have and the communities that I'm part of, but they don't see the graft and the investment that I made to be part of them, right? Like when I'm at home, like every weekend I have a cookout. 30 people come into the house, like guests who are in London, they're passing through, and you invite them, you invite people, introduce people to people. Like, I don't have to do that. I don't gain any benefit from it other than the relationships of those people in that space. But I genuinely feel that the best investment you can make in life is people. And if I have to look at my life and what some of the biggest milestones I've had is that every success of mine has come from someone putting me on from this community because of the positive relationship we've had together. And I'm so grateful for that. But how to is understanding that you have to graft for it. It's some of the most beautiful things in life are difficult. And it's difficult to arrive to a new city and like figure out what the energy is, et cetera, and find the right like-minded people. But the only thing really truly that I like to think of how I navigate this is the only thing you have control over is yourself, right? I can only control who I am that will attract the energy that I want to be part of. You can't control everything else. Why are you trying to like force this person to be your friend? And so what I've kind of learned is that, look, like if I'm as magnetic as I can be, if I'm as genuine and real as I can be, like-minded people will find me. I read something recently, which I really loved, which was, we spend so long being someone else, then why are we surprised that the right people aren't finding you? And like, we've all felt walking into a cafe or a room where everyone is just like performing, right? And like what I've come to realize is just love sitting in like who I am and being like genuine and real with that. And then like other people on that same wave are like, you're cool. And then you vibe and it leads to like incredible things. But you have to contribute. You have to be like, what can I contribute to this community? You can't just take away, right?
Give value.
Exactly. Mm. So you yourself have to contribute to the said community. It's also about being genuine and real and understanding like who you are, that the right community can find you. And thirdly, you really have to do your due diligence. When I arrived in South Africa, I had never been before. And I was a big lover of the culture. I came in like not just like turning up, but like I had done my work. I had done research on who were the artists doing incredible things, events that were happening over the next 2 weeks. And then I started being present in those spaces, and then people within them started to like invite me to other things. And it led to such an amazing, the community in South Africa just embraced me, and it was such a beautiful thing to feel part of. And then I hosted a dinner there for everyone that contributed to my trip at the end of the trip. And people remember this stuff, you know, and that's how over time relationships build and they manifest. But you know, why community is really important is because there's such a lack of community today, right? You live in a flat.
Mm-hmm.
A flat is the most antithetical thing to a mm-hmm. sense of community. You live in this box and this high rise, but there's no neighborhood for you to walk out, neighborhoods, et cetera, neighbors. And all of us have now been constrained into these living environments, which doesn't facilitate a sense of like interpersonal relationships with anybody. And what we need to do is get to a deep sense of what IRL human communities look like, and putting ourselves out there again. And I think we've just forgotten to do that. We only know how to communicate digitally, which has its use, of course. But there is something about like striking up a conversation with a random dude at the cafe or whatever. But now, yeah, all of us have dating apps and Instagram, sliding in DMs. But what happened to candid conversations and serendipitous moments?
Mm.
You know, I'm finding myself like really wanting to facilitate spaces for that. Like I love striking up a conversation with someone randomly. Life can be really exciting if you let it be so.
You know what? That's so true. Like the other day I was waiting for the lift in my flat and I got in the elevator and the other guy came in who lives that two doors down. And then I saw that he had the Mauritian flag on his thing. And I was like,
what are the chances?
Are you Mauritian?
It's like 10,000.
He was like, yes, I am. I was like, we lived two doors down for 4 years.
Crazy.
We've never spoken. I didn't even know because there's no way. But again, if I didn't just have a conversation, you never know.
Beautiful. Right? Exactly.
Right. But
yeah.
Sorry. No, keep going.
No, I'm just saying so put yourself out there and wonderful things happen. It's like that yes theory, right? Like if you are open to people and their energy, they will, you know, it will come back to you. A lot of my friends find it difficult, by the way. And this is where like building community can be a challenge, is that like a lot of friends have told me that like they feel closer to me than how I make them feel.
Oh yeah, we've talked about that.
Right?
Yeah.
And like, and I, what they mean by that is that like I have so much friends and community around the world and I'm very close to them that some people with smaller friendship groups feel like I have less time for them.
Right.
Right. Which practically, yes, on a day-to-day time basis, just by sheer logic, yes, probably like your
too
energy.
Popular. Yeah.
No, but like what I mean is, is that I love you just as much as you love me.
Right? Yeah. It's the just feeling like, is mutual.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. And like what you're happening is that what you're learning in the community is that people give out love uniquely and they receive love uniquely.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I might be this persona that like gives out love in a specific way, but a lot of my close friends need it in a very different, unique way. Mm-hmm. I think part of facilitating like a vibrant community is like, especially if you want to be a leader in that, is understanding how the people in your community need to receive that love and attention.
Mm-hmm.
So this person needs more attention in this context.
Mm-hmm.
This person needs some time together. And that's really key in facilitating it. Another thing is like how to be an amazing host. Like I host so many dinners and I want to write something about this, but like being a host is a very delicate job. You have to understand it's a curation of energy. Like how you are dictates the energy of the space. If I'm like stressed out and I'm like panicky, the space will be like that. If I bring people, just because I'm a chameleon, it means that I can get on with this kind of person. And a totally different kind of person doesn't mean that they're going to connect in this space.
Mm-mm.
So being a host also means about curation of that for the sake of the general energy of the space.
Mm-hmm.
And also space. Like, look, my dad always said, we have a small house in London,
mm-hmm.
but people have become so prissy with space. It's nuts. I grew up where like, if there was a cubic meter in the house, you slept in it. And we had like 20 people living in it. That's how we grew up. But now people have 3-bedroom houses and one is for like a closet and another is for their dog, right?
Yeah.
And they don't want to have anyone to sleep over. That's crazy to me. Like my dad always said, it's not how big your home is, how big your heart is. And like, that's the kind of ethos in which our house ran, was created under. So you come to my house on a Sunday evening and I'm hosting a cookout. It's shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, there's
people
no space.
Bursting through the seams, no space. People are sitting over each other, but it also facilitates like realness.
Now you have to speak to each other.
Yeah, exactly. And like people are like laughing, chatting, and there's games. And like, that's the three things that take to being a great host, which facilitates community.
Yeah. And I think also, as you were saying, we have now become so dependent on digital communication. We forget real life. And I read this excerpt literally today. Sahil Bloom's book is coming out, and we're having him on the podcast next week, so I was preparing. And he said, think about who will be sitting in the first row at your funeral. How much time do you spend with them now? And that makes you realize that even your closest friend, right, you start trying, you take them for granted. You're 100%. Like, you know I love you. I know you love me. It's fine. But we need to spend time with them as well.
100%. And I think we're all guilty of like neglecting probably the most important people in my life. And I've been thinking about that a lot. I think I'm just, I think you get better at that with age. Like
100%.
I feel like I'm starting to realize like I have a lot less time, especially in our work where a lot of it is socializing, going to these events and like whatever. I'm starting to realize that like how much value is this socializing with people that you barely know. Mm-hmm. Like I just want to kind of get deeper with people I already love. And like, I definitely believe in that. It's like, I only really want to give my entirety to people who have always made me their priority. And, it's a lesson you learn with time, I think.
Absolutely.
A large part of your 20s is like, you throw numbers. Your energy out there.
Yeah.
You throw your energy out there. You're experimenting because you also don't know what energy you're kind of responsive to either. And I believe you have to go through that.
Yeah. And you're learning more about yourself as well. Yeah. What works for you, what doesn't.
Yeah. And like, you pray that you just don't get like, traumatically hurt in that process via these friendships and relationships, but you learn, you come home, you start to realize that this is the energy I want to be around.
Well, what's the parting message that you have for the audience?
Parting message would be, gosh, you said some lovely things about me today, which I'm very grateful for. To respond to the lovely things that you said to me in closing, I would say like, I am a product of my environment. So it's very difficult for me to take credit for like my parents who I put a lot of it on, but also my community, my friends who check me, my ego, where I am with my work and my ethics and my morals. And I guess my parting message is kind of how we closed it, is community. It's like you are the sum of the parts around you. And like why I feel like community should be one of the first things that you prioritize on is that the right community behind you will make sure you're the best version of yourself. And I feel really passionate about that. I really feel like if I ever was to become like a multi-billionaire, like my first dream is just to put everyone around me that I love deeply and just like support them throughout their entirety of their lives, because like there would be no me without them. So I feel really passionate about that. And in the context of technology, AI, all these things like kind of detaching us from the human, my leaving message is like, consider, revise, reflect on what is being human to you. And like for all of us, it will mean different things. But there is so much temptation that's pulling us away from that. And a large part of that spiritual process for all of us is going to be realigning with the human. If AI and all of this stuff that we're observing is going to push us to reflect on is like, it's our humanity more. So community, humanity, and more vulnerability with yourself, like and be open to all the like pitfalls and ups and downs of life, and I want to thank you also. This has been fun, finally.
Well, thank you so much, Nader, for coming on the podcast. Only 45 minutes late, but thank you so much for coming, and I hope this was fun.
No, thank you for having me. Next time we're gonna do this again.
Part 2.